This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
It's my pleasure to introduce Aaron Levy, who is the director of the Slot Foundation, and all of the people at Slot Foundation who make their program so interesting in Philadelphia and make Philadelphia a place that's a place for a very inspired dialogue. I think that's a very important role that they're playing there. So I applaud that. I applaud Aaron. And it's wonderful to have the Slot Foundation here in New York at the Drawing Center for the evening. So I just wanted to mention that the exhibition that you're in the midst of at the moment is called Common Destination, and it's a very fitting exhibition to be here around you to be discussing ex-cities, because all the things that you see are fragments of cities in some way or another that the artists have been working with. So I'll pass everything to Aaron now, and thank you again.
Thank you for coming tonight. It's an amazing showing. First of all, I'd like to actually thank NYU for making this possible. We're quite literally piggybacking on a wonderful series of programs over the last few days that have taken place at NYU featuring Helen Tsitsu, and that have been organized by Judith Miller, who's going to be speaking as well tonight. And so I'd like to thank Judith as well, both for speaking here tonight, participating in this, but also for making it possible to have Helen here. Tonight we've convened to celebrate Helen Tsitsu and Maria Cheska, and Maria has quite literally arrived from Kennedy an hour and a half ago. But by way of an introduction, before turning it over to the various kind of remarkable academics and theorists and critics that are going to say a few remarks informally tonight, I actually want to say a few words not so much about Helen. They will speak to Helen's work and to Helen's role in their life. But I want to actually speak to Maria's practice. And in doing so, of course, it's on the occasion of this amazing publication that we're launching tonight. But I also wanted to gesture to the exhibition that took place 1 year ago, roughly, in Philadelphia at Slot. And the publication is not meant to simply document that. It's meant as a second iteration. But this conversation between Helen and Maria and between Helen and Maria and Slot began with that exhibit. So 2 years ago, Maria contacted Jean-Michel while he was in Europe. Slot has kind of three figures. Jean-Michel Robertet will speak shortly, Oswaldo Romberg, and myself. And Helen had contacted, Maria had contacted Jean-Michel while he was traveling in Europe and had kind of proposed a project for Philadelphia. And we had all agreed to this. And what resulted was a fairly odd curatorial process where Maria was displaced from the site. She was displaced from Philadelphia, and we were following her procedures in enacting this project. And so this book was given to me in Paris, and I took it back. It has about 60 pages of detailed notes or manuscripts. And we had to follow this to enact this exhibit. And it's going to be returned to Maria tonight, ritualistically. And Maria, in this installation, created a room full of objects and a room full of furniture, a lived environment, albeit one that belonged to a stranger. And the stranger was incredibly physically absent, but uncannily present. And Helen, of course, arrived in Philadelphia and, on the occasion of the opening, delivered this remarkable seminar that spoke to the cities of her upbringing, cities real and imagined, cities lost, destroyed, lived in, reconstituted. And so the book kind of seeks to convey the spirit of that evening in a number of ways. And one of the ways is that Helen's writings from that evening are quite literally the cover of the book. Helen's talk that evening was in English, but in the book we've published it bilingually in English and in French. And we've also included an audio CD such that this theme of translation, which is so central to Helen's work, the impossibility of translation, the possibility of translation, the playfulness of translation, is kind of conveyed in the book three times over, in English, in French, and also in the audio version. And the title of the book is called, it's called Ex-Cities. And Ex-Cities, of course, could be understood in many ways. One of the ways that we could even just begin to think of it is in relationship to all the cities today and in the past that have met misfortune. Cities, and this list could go on, New Orleans, Venice, Pompeii, but also the cities of Helene's own writings, such as the ones that figured in last night's production or stage reading at NYU in Drums on the Dam, that was performed at the Tisch School of the Arts. The title, as I said, is called Ex-Cities, but the title of Helene's essay in the book is called Promise Cities. And this reminds us, in a certain sense, as so much of Helene's work does, of the ways in which art doesn't just inform our ideas about sociality and living, but teaches us how to invoke the future, how to promise life, how to give life itself, and to think in terms of how to invent the future through practice, to live life through living. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm just going to turn it over to those that will follow. Judith Miller will speak for a few minutes next. Then Eric Krenowitz, Jean-Michel Rabaté, and Avital Renaud last. And Helene may entertain a few questions if you have some in the period that follows. So thanks again for coming.
Good evening. This will be very short, and it really is a dialogue that I had with myself and with Ex-Cities as soon as I read it. And this is for Helene, who has inspired me to write by association instead of my usual cut and rep. A city is always 12 cities. A word is always 12 words. Ex-cities might mean excite eye, might mean exit ties, might mean excite ease. Helene Cixous lives in a thickness of meanings, a shimmering, playful, but terribly serious state of life in dreams and dreams in life, where past, present, and future are and have always been connected. This is not the easy connection of pantheism. It is the uneasy, diseasy linkage of human madness, of destruction, of exile, and ensuing pain. And then, of return, rebirth, regeneration, or their promise. Helene Cixous is a writer who promises, who wishes to promise, who promiscuously words a promise of love. Love in the ruins. And what are these ruins? Not endings, never endings, but the beginnings of renewal of a literature, which is not, as Verlaine would hope not, all the rest, but rather sounds, lights, colors, charm, such charm. Helene Cixous reconstructs on the bodies of dead women a new theater, and thus resurrects women. And on the bodies of destroyed cities, rebirth sites. She writes the world a Whitman-esque energy to say it all, and in saying, do. Helene Cixous translates, she tells us, from the languages transgressing her. She takes and multiplies. Jacques Derrida has recognized in this a certain unreadability, which becomes a call to creative partnering. Helene's texts are not alone, but a column. The title, she calls out, is the sublime translation of the book. I respond thus to translating, transmuting. Excite I, and I too can write. Exit ties, and there is no end. There is no way out. Words are what bind and unbind us. Once in a text by Helene Cixous, one is tied to the sight and called to sight, to not be at ease, but to be at ex-ease, to seek the ex-ease of the sight,
its vulnerability, its movability, and its infinite possibilities for invention.
I'm going to talk a little bit about what my relationship to this project is, and then I'm going to try to say a few things about my sense of Hélène Cixous's relationship to cities. Aaron first asked me simply to write a biographical note for this book that he was putting together, very simply, and that's what I did. And I'll do that here too a little bit, but one of the most important things that I ended up saying was how divided I was about doing that, in particular for Hélène Cixous. On the one hand, it's very important to know that Hélène Cixous was born in Algeria, that she was born into a very unusual Jewish family in Algeria. I'm doing a biographical note, right? Which was both Ashkenazi and Sephardic. Her mother is a German Jew, and her father was an Algerian Jew, which says something about cultural difference and mixtures. That she was, it's important to know what Algeria was at that time, the mixture of Arab, French, Jewish in Algeria. It's important to know that she grew up during the war in Algeria, and that, for instance, that her French citizenship, she was expelled from French citizenship, for instance, by the Vichy government, et cetera, et cetera. It's important to know that her father was a doctor, and that he did battle with tuberculosis, and that he died from tuberculosis when she was a young child. It's important to know that she went to France as a young woman, and that she became one of the, I would say, 10 most important writers and thinkers ever. These are all very important things in reading her work. At the same time, in writing this biographical note, I had to think that it's also a dangerous thing, dangerous and misleading to think that there's that one can just describe the life separate from the literature, and that. In some way, her writing, her life is constantly transmuted, always into literature. I think it's very important in reading Hélène Cixous to almost to forget the person, the biography, and to be able to read the text for the text alone. At the same time, it's crucially important, and it's almost the case that for her biography, her life, my life, in her writing, is even more important than that it's not just a context, right, within which the writer writes, but that it's transformed into her writing. So, I mean, in one sense, this is one of the reasons why the city is so important. I mean, the city is one of the places where, in Cixous's writing, where somehow reality and fiction are one of the places where reality becomes literature, and you see this in many of her texts. I wanted to just take one example. Which was some of you were at the talk this afternoon, and I was turning the pages, and one citation I wanted to take was a place where she is talking about her relationship with Derrida, and a series of texts written by Derrida about her. And she talks about the situation in which she finds herself before these texts. She talks about a text called Veils, H.C. for Life, and Généalogie, Genre, and the Génie, which are the three big texts that Derrida wrote about her, or three of them. And she says in these texts, I quote, "I found myself in front of Vales, in front of HC for Life, and in front of Genèse, found in front even as I found myself within." And we have to look at the French text here too, because she's using a French expression, se trouver, in which both finding herself before and within the text, which is to say, she's reading the text, but she's in the text, right? And this is the point at which I wanted to continue. Find is not exactly the word. I lost myself right of way, as in my native city of Oran, when as a child I had gone completely astray there. It was not me, it was not her. A great veil of fog enveloped us, as I recounted in Savoir. Now some of you will know Savoir is the text that she wrote, which was included in the book that's called Veils, and that she's describing a scene that she describes in Savoir, in which she, as a little child in Oran, her native city in Algeria, she got lost in a fog. But of course, in this text of hers, the fog, which is the city, which happens in the city one day, she's describing something which is a biographical fact, right? One day she got lost as a little child going to school in a city. This fog in the text is also an interior fog, right? It's also something that's inside of her, because she's also describing, which is another biographical fact, her myopia, right? And so she talks here about a great veil of fog enveloped us, and the us here is she. It is me and her, right? Because they're two people. There's already two people. So you see in this text that what's happening in the city is also a reflection of what's happening inside of her. And this is a whole beautiful, amazing text about the question of seeing and not seeing, her myopia as being this veil, which is removed at one point, and the whole question of... So, I mean, this is one example of... where this kind of thing happens. There'd be a lot of other things to say about this, because even about the question of, for instance, in this case, she finds herself, on one hand, there are two of them. There's I and there's she. And there's also the situation in which she finds herself before this book, right? Because in the text that Hélène Cixous read this afternoon, she's also, she's finding herself... she's describing a very particular situation where she's reading a book by Jacques Derrida about her. So she's both in front of it and in it, right? Which is part of the strange losing of herself, right? That she finds that happens to her in the face of these texts. And I would say that that's another way in which she links it here immediately to the relationship to the city, right? She's in the city and before the city. It's almost as if the city is reading her as much, right, because Derrida is reading her. The fact that she's in the text of Derrida is to say that she's the one that's being read by the other person, right? Derrida's reading her. And that's another dimension of, I would say, the what happens in the relationship between reality and fiction for Cixous. Here, you don't even know, not only is it hard to know where reality stops and fiction begins, but in this case, for instance, it's almost as if the city could be reading her, right? So it goes both ways. I wanted to say one other example, which I thought was something that might be illuminating, is the example of a recent film filmed by Hélène Cixous, which I had the good fortune to see recently. Not very long ago, the filmmaker Ruth Beckerman asked Hélène Cixous to film herself going to Algeria. She took a trip to Algeria for the first time in years and years, decades. And she asked her to film herself, which she did, and she gave her a camera. And the result is an absolutely remarkable film, which I'll just describe a tiny little bit. And the lesson for me is also a lesson in what writing is for Helen Csiksu. I mean, on the one hand, it's what she sees, what a city is for her. And it's certainly true that she's certainly not a tourist, the cities seem to be, they're living things in a very unusual way. What I really want to stress here is that Helen Csiksu accepted to bring this camera, although as far as I know, she never used a camera before. So it's very unusual camera work. And it's also obviously also very charged, her going back to Algeria and filming the most important things in a certain sense. And what's crucially important, it seems to me, is again the way it's filmed. And you see there are various different scenes. I mean, you don't see Algeria in a certain sense, right? You don't learn, in one way you don't learn much about Algeria in a touristy way, but in another way you learn a huge amount. But in particular, what's so striking about this film is that there's something that's absolutely recognizable as Helen Csiksu's writing. In this medium that is not at all her medium, right? And so, there are scenes where she sets the camera up and talks to the camera, and she's in one or two of these scenes, the camera is set up on a table or on a bed, and she's recounting Algeria, and there are these unbelievable monologue dialogues, and in one of them, the camera is set up in such a way that it's not framed very well, as sort of the way you'd say it, and you see her mouth. But this wasn't—I mean, I don't know how to describe this because what I'm describing is something that wasn't intentionally done. But the camera is framed in such a way that there's something very frustrating about it, because you want to see her face. She's filming herself, right? She's and she's describing, she's talking about the promised land, inside and outside, arriving, going back, returning, being able to go to the place where you want to go. And slowly, as this monologue continues, the camera slowly moves up her face, right? And all of this is not calculated, right? At least that's what you have to think. And at the same time, you see that there's it's as if she were using a tool that she does not master, and yet she does something that's very, very moving, very, very moving and very masterful with it, right? And it just seems there's a way in which there's a very striking aspect to this, which says something about her writing, which is to say that she's able to use she's able to both be completely the master of her writing and in some sense be completely inventing it at the same time, right? That she I think maybe that's enough for right now. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for being here with us, being so numerous. And I'd like to say a few words first about Slot and what we've been doing and why this thing tonight, why here, why with Helen Csiksu, why do books what we do at SWOLD, and we're not the only one, but I think it's a recent trend today, is to show artists, visual artists, or to have concerts, but also do books and have talks and invite authors and have discussions. And it's in this context that we saw the importance of Hélène Cixous' work, not so much as a writer, as a playwright, as a critic, and so on, but also as somebody who was eager to engage in a dialogue with an artist we liked, Maria Chevska. So the book tries to be as faithful as possible to the variety and the richness of this experience, Hélène Cixous' inimitable style in French and in English, and photographs of the work, and a CD. But for those of you who know that we've all been inspired by Jacques Derrida, you will say, what strange paradox, what strange contradiction, why have a book with a CD? Hasn't someone like Derrida insisted that a book was a negation of the voice, that writing by itself prohibited any recourse to the living voice? At the same time, this is true, but we may remember that it is only from what he declared as his love for presence that Jacques Derrida could then insist on difference. And I want to see this in connection with the presence of Hélène Cixous here. So we are all here tonight, and you know, this could be called an event because we have a book and we have the author of the book ready to respond, which doesn't mean that Hélène will speak publicly, but at least she'll be ready to talk with you individually if you have questions. You might say that for a Derridean again, this is something that one should avoid. But no, I think on the contrary, we want to multiply those interventions, and I think your number shows that there is a certain need there. And having heard Hélène's wonderful talk this afternoon, going back to Veils and this dialogue that she's had for a long time with Jacques Derrida, I was reminded of a little anecdote, a little story that I don't think I even told her, which dates back to the time when I had just started working with both Hélène and Jacques Derrida at the École Normale Supérieure. And being very excited, I happened to talk with Louis Althusser. I don't know whether his name will be familiar to some of you, a very well-known Marxist, French Marxist philosopher, who heard me and a friend say that we were really so happy, so proud to be working with them. And he didn't say anything about Hélène, but about Jacques Derrida, he said something that I first heard as a sort of snide comment, and I'm happy it has to be first said in French, because it's, and then I'll translate it. He says, oh, Derrida, c'est le champion du monde de saut. Mais le problème, c'est qu'il croit que c'est du saut en longueur, et en fait, il est champion du saut en hauteur. I'll translate this. Derrida is the world champion of jumping, and happily, he thinks that it is distance jumping, and he's only high, doing high jumping. Meditating this slightly cryptic, and we thought a little nasty comment, not being sure what to make of it, was Althusser saying that Derrida was misled when he thought, for instance, that he was destroying Western metaphysics, or was he, you know, jumping sur place instead of... And then, you know, I forgot this slightly cryptic comment. And it's only today, hearing Hélène Cixous talking about Veils, that in fact I understood that Althusser was recognizing that there was something in Derrida and in Hélène Cixous as well that he didn't possess,
which was being an author, la hauteur, so en hauteur, with this pun, which sends me to what I'll have to say. I keep learning from Hélène Cixous. Last June, there was a very huge celebration, homage in Paris 8, founded mostly by Hélène Cixous after 68. And even though I thought I knew many things about her work, I realized that I didn't know so many things, like the political aspect of her work, her vision of a new university just after the events of 68, her sense of daring innovation at a time when the French university was really more medieval, or let's say 19th century, in terms of style than the American or other countries' universities, and her ability to work with a group of people from various political origins and various factions who all accepted to collaborate on that project. That was amazing to see witnesses talk about this. My own experience also dates back from those years, a little later. But I think I've learned other things from Hélène as a dissertation supervisor, which she was for me, which was fundamentally, apart from the openness of her approach and the fact that she allowed me to do a PhD in English that had one half on an Austrian author, which I think shocked some of our colleagues, the fact that, as she would show in her example, and this is something that I try to tell my students, I'm here really talking about the pedagogical side, but I think Hélène's writing has a pedagogical effect, was that, as we know, reading her books, writing is an experience. It's not exactly, so here I'm moving away from a sort of old Derridean position. What I mean by this is that when we start something, we don't know what we are really going to write. But very often, this is the problem. Students start with an idea, and then the test of writing has to be made, and then maybe something else completely different happens. So this is something that she always taught me. She would always say, just write, and then we'll see. So I'll end with this, going back to something she's been associated with in Paris, in France, with écriture féminine, that I think was for a while what she had launched, and I think maybe she'll want to say a few words about this, but I think what stands out now is écriture. And I was always, for instance, impressed by the fact that she'd said in a famous footnote of the Laughter of Medusa that for her, a good example of écriture féminine was Jean Genet. And so I would say simply that, as Jacques Derrida recently said in the last book, the book on Hélène Cixous, in the Génie, Genius, what he showed was that Hélène Cixous, by mastering more than one language, for instance, German is a very important language for her, native language, you might say, French, English, she has mastered something like what we say in French, le génie de la langue, the genius of languages or of French or other languages. In that sense, indeed, she is literally and in many senses an author. This is perhaps what Althusser had in mind. Thank you.
Everyone for being here to honor our beloved Hélène Cixous, and I think I'll just pick up where you left off with a kind of pedagogical inflection. In other words, I'm shedding and shredding as we speak here because I had quite a lot that I wanted to discuss with you today about her work, her person, her political inscriptions and inflections, the contours and modalities of my own gratitude, which can only be offered with a quiver of anxiety, and certainly the complex, sometimes ambivalent, yet powerful conjunctions that we've been performing between Derrida, whom she's brought back with her on this trip, and Cixous, whose singularity also requires that we try to wonder about their apartness and where they don't speak and their silences, which I'll get to momentarily. I was invited by Aaron to speak about my relation to Hélène Cixous, which would be very, very tremendous a task to bring to you in a nanosecond. So I can't hope to give anything but a little metonymy of what that relationship might be seen as. I've been influenced, invaded, carried, rescued, and in some ways, I think, loved by Hélène Cixous, or that's my projection and need. She's been my boss, my queen. She's actually, you know, when I was down and out in Paris, that's a city that I was down and out in, and I had been kicked out of the University of Virginia at the time. And I was without work. I was jobless. And Hélène Cixous offered me a job. And however, it was on credit. And I promised her I would one day have been, to use Derrida's temporal sway, I will have been worthy of her confidence in me if she could just open a credit account for me. And so I remember very well her drive. I think she had a driver, a student who drove her, and we were in the car, and we were going to her office to constitute my CV. And Hélène had a lot of work, I think, to do, and I was a little pain in the ass who she wanted to help and get it over with already, I thought. And so she started saying, okay, here's your CV. You've written on this, this, and this. And I said, but I haven't. And I think I annoyed her. And she said, you will have. So I'm the potentiality of a great Shakespeare scholar, by the way, and Trollope. And I swear, I still haven't paid that debt, because I haven't yet worked on some of the text for which articles and splendid titles were given. You know, I don't know. I hesitated to expose this kind of cheat sheet and my rap sheet and how I started off on borrowing power, very capital also. I borrowed. I arrived on credit thanks to this tremendous generosity and risk-taking being that gave me my first job after having been in front of the firing squad at the University of Virginia. So that started me anew. That gave me the microcredit for which the Nobel Prize was given out just a couple of days ago. And in many discreet ways, I've continued to incorporate and enact Hélène's teachings in ways that would not seem necessarily part of a lineage or part of a legit kind of legacy bearing. For example, what I consider to be the feminist hours that she teaches in, which I haven't actually held in at NYU, but at Berkeley, I would give seminars every other week on Saturdays or Sundays for about 9 hours, which is what Hélène does. And there I would, the other day when she asks, who has time? This is in the way she's lived with time and written on time and inscribed time, including the time is out of joint. And when she was 50, or claims to have been 50 at some point, her relation to time and
and what it means to live in our age has been thematized, has been kind of mapped in very intense ways. So I would give these seminars following her schedule, which allowed working women and others to come to class on a weekend. And also it did something. If you can imagine a class that lasts 9 hours with mini reports and micro interventions and just reading the same paragraph for about 9 hours and deciding that, that was on the fast lane, and deciding we had to do that for a whole semester and so on and so forth. All of that, including maybe certain makeup decisions, are due to my great mentor and teacher and sometime tormentor as well. So, which is part of this intense and amazing relationship that you have to one who has saved you and repeated the save. As a matter of fact, she doesn't even know that when I came as a stowaway one day to NYU, this was the last time she was here. She was speaking to Tom Bishop, and she welcomed me and hugged me and kissed me, and I got instant legitimacy. And here I am, professor at NYU, and it was that moment when she just hugged me and I sat on her lap as, you know, and Tom Bishop then invited me to lunch, and the rest is history, you know. So today I was thinking of reading something. If you have the patience and what the Germans call Sitzfleisch, can you sit for another 2 minutes? I wanted my real presentation and offering was to be on the narcissisms of my two beloved teachers, Jacques Derrida and Hélène Cixous. But the ecological mappings will have to wait for another time. I will just say to you what Derrida writes about narcissism and his relationship to Hélène in HC for Life, that is to say. So this is about narcissism, and one should not get carried away and hasten to believe that one knows what narcissism is and means. Narcissism has no contrary, no other side, no beyond, and love for the other, respect for the other, self-denial in favor of the other do not interrupt any narcissistic movement. Now that's news. It's a real news flash. One must love oneself living in order to love the other. Only the impotence of a petty narcissism blocks off love for the other. This is, as you know, what Eco teaches Narcissus. To love the other as oneself, the mightier narcissism is, the more it loves the other. And in order to love the other as oneself, more than oneself, introjection and incorporation, this surplus is needed, always more of it, this more than possible, that is the most impossible. Here is Angelius Silesius, who says, das Überunmöglichste ist möglich, which can be translated in two different ways. Either the most impossible is possible, or else the more than impossible is possible. It all depends on the stroke of genius and how good it is at making excess, über, tremble between the comparative and the superlative, and so on and so forth. Narcissism is the elementary condition for love. Apart from myself, will I dare say that I know nobody who is more impossibly narcissistic than Hélène Cixous in her life, her works? I could say that apart from myself. That's why she and I keep each other at a respectful distance and with the greatest possible respect, each to one side. And then I would have wanted to read to you what Cixous says about and put in dialogue. I am not an egotist. I do not want what I want. and so on and so forth. But I will urge you to do that reading yourselves, because I'm very delighted to hear that Hélène might respond to some questions, and I do want to open the floor to that. So let us honor her, and thank you all for being here to do so.
I'm sure you pity me, but it's terrible, you know, to receive such a large quantity, amount, immeasurable of what I simply call love, although I don't know what I say when I say that, of course. And to remain in the Derridean sphere or world, I have become terribly indebted in 20 minutes. I owe so much now. I don't know how I shall ever repay all that, except by going on loving my friends, of course. But this is endless, endless gratitude. So thank you, each of us, and all of you, and thank you, Jacques Derrida, who is inspiring everything here. And even this little anecdote, which it's a treasure, I'm trying to repay my debt. I'm giving you a treasure. as regards narcissism, which is indeed it's a huge, wonderful theme of reflection, and we spoke about narcissism very often, Derrida and me. I think that I suspected that we comforted each other by telling us respectively that, after all, it's not bad. but, you know, since we are talking about cities, which, by the way, I use the word only when I'm in the States or somewhere in an Anglophone context, because for me it's ville in French. And ville, of course, sounds differently, is extremely, it's a cunning word. It's a homonym. For instance, ville has a twin, which is ville. But ville, the other ville, or this ville, the other ville, is connotated in a really dreadful way in French. It's vile. It's vileness. And so maybe it's interesting to realize that there is something vile in a ville, in its foundation, as we know. I mean, all cities are vilely founded, violently founded on murder, etc. And also, all cities, all villes, have their chaotic aspect, their ignoble sides. So not all are desirable. I mean, part of the city is, on the contrary, repulsive and frightening. But to come back to ville and the signifier, it's also it also contains vie. And we could go on, of course, at length, the way Judith did it playfully, wonderfully. Let me address myself to Maria, my English friend. Since we did something together, Maria, me, Aaron,
Jean-Michel, and gradually our ship has been peopled with all kinds of different voyages, travelers. We started, without knowing it, on a strange odyssey. And all our different memories were solicited, so that we eventually did something which then was translated into a book. And the book, the idea of translating all these experiences that belong to different arts and expressions, plus d'une langue, Derrida would say, more than one tongue, the idea, I suppose, was Aaron's. So now we are all living in that little portable house that is this book. And it all started with our dreams or phantasms of cities that none of those cities were identical, but it produced a kind of ghost or emanation of a dream city. But for me, actually, a city is a book. It's always been a book, a huge book. First of all, from my childhood, as Eric reminded us, I became a reader because I was trying to decipher the city in which I was dropped, lost, both at the level of its structure, which was totally mysterious. It had, for me, of course, it had the structure of a labyrinth, and also at the level of the signifier, because it was called Oran, and for me, Oran was a composition of French phonemes, words, syllables that brought me across the world. When I say that, it's not only because I'm a reader of cities, but cities look like a collection of books. You know, going through Manhattan today, I was, as usual, I mean, as every time I come here, I was looking at this city with the most intense feeling of intense familiarity, an intense and equally intense feeling of foreignness. And these two affects are, for me, totally inseparable. I feel as familiar as I feel foreign. And this is an effect of the city, the mystery, the enigma, and the strange life of a city. I used to have the unanalyzed feeling that Manhattan, amongst American cities, is always the same. I've come to Manhattan for 42 years now, and for me, it's the same Manhattan. Actually, I feel even a bit relieved when I arrive here, because it's still there, apart from the towers. But the towers are still there. So, and it's exactly the same, which is, I mean, this is a feature that, of course, belongs to European cities, but to American cities it's different. But here it is the same Manhattan, eternal Manhattan. But today, I looked up, and there were two new towers. For you, they're not new. And I was with Aaron and Eric, and I said, are these new? And we were near Central Park. And yes, you know, apparently they're new towers. Apparently they're, if we were not mistaken, the Time Warner towers. Of course, I immediately associated with the signifier Warner. And I thought it's Derrida, he who warns us about time. Hmm? Of course, it's a kind of sign, of signal, of growth. And again, all those buildings, they particularly in the States, because of course in Europe it's rather different, they all look like books on shelves, you know. So I go through the shelves, the strange shelves of that strange library that is Manhattan. Now let me come to my treasure. I've written a book that's called Manhattan, and that was a couple of years ago. Actually, it appeared in 2001. At that time, it's now being translated. It will come out in the States shortly, and it's been translated by Peggy Kamoff, a great dirigent. And I had, as usual, a problem with the names, titles. And as usual, I would talk about my feeling of uncertainty and fright to Jacques Derrida, particularly regarding naming. And so I was shy, and I thought it's ridiculous to call a book Manhattan. Also, you know, I am a scholar, so I know that there is a book that is called Manhattan already. But I, at the same time, it was the obvious secret name of this book. And but since I was shy of using this title, and the book was already being under print, you know, so I called Derrida and asked him, what do you think? I think I shouldn't call a book Manhattan, you know. It's and also it was in the period that was that followed, that immediately followed, I mean the printing session was immediately following, of course, 9/11. I thought, I can't call a book Manhattan. So he immediately told me, but it's obvious that it's Manhattan. And he was so sure, you know, he was so, for him, it was so unquestionable that I felt immediately reassured, at peace, and I thought, then, of course, it's obvious that it's there. I didn't see it, but he sees it, so it's Manhattan. I think it's, if I were a reader of that book, I would think it's really audacious, or, I mean, it's a challenge, and it's very imprudent to call a book Manhattan. It can, you know, it can be then mistaken for a guidebook, for instance. Things like that. Okay. But regarding names and giving names, he would remark to me that he couldn't understand how I could ask what he thought about a title and be happy with his approval or his disapproval, which never happened, but still, it might have happened. And he would tell me that he would never in his life accept that anybody touch his name or any name of his. And that was true. That made a difference between us. I could accept that somebody I love and respect would somehow give me an advice or suggest or disapprove. He would never have accepted that. That was very clear. Now, who was the more narcissistic? Was it him or was it me? He who would say, don't touch my name, that's my name, or me who would say, touch my name. Let's open to questions if you have any.
In your remarks, you just said, quote, of course the towers are still there, unquote. As a New Yorker, I would be very comforted if you could please explain why you think that.
It, It's my feeling. Of course, I don't want to affirm, and I wouldn't swear for everybody that they are still there, because I cannot, of course, generalize, nor and I know very well that the relation we all have to event, to appearance, disappearance, to destruction, resurrection, etc. It's every time totally, specifically singular. So I don't know how many we are here, maybe 150. I'm sure that there are 150 versions of the Twin Towers, 150 at least memories and oblivions of the Twin Towers, and each of those memories or oblivions is full of other memories and oblivions, so there probably are 1,000 ghosts of the Twin Towers here. My feeling is that for the time being, at least, they're still here. I don't live, I don't be live, I don't believe that beings, whatever, come to an end when they seem to have been destroyed, pulled down, buried. Because I think that as long as they are invited in me, in some of you, they go on as usual. I can even say, as usual, as long as we do the work of keeping them alive as friends, companions in the city. And I must say, of course, one would see the Twin Towers, but one would also not see them while they were there, erect. One would drive by, forget about them, and it's just the same now. Maybe it's my way of resisting, of refusing, but as long as I succeed, as long as I don't feel I have a big hole in my back, but that I have instead a fire in my heart, so it works. I don't say that it's going to last forever. Why? Because I'm doing my best. It's a work. I labor to keep them. In the shape and body they now have. But I'm not alone. As you said, as a New Yorker, I'm not a New Yorker. There are millions of New Yorkers. And it may happen that New Yorkers, or old Yorkers, or new New Yorkers, or old New Yorkers, etc., etc., Yorkers, eventually, really wipe them out. It may happen. Exactly as you would see in Proust, I'm borrowing the metaphor that he uses, and I think is extraordinarily beautiful. He, speaking about love, I mean the narrator, speaking about love and the love that he has for the character called Albertine, he has a kind of premonition. The premonition is that he has seen the two apocalyptic beasts, the lion and Python. Is it Python or it's Python? Python and the Python. And It throws the narrator in a panic. The lion, it's a huge lion, is love. The python is forgetfulness. The narrator is everything. The lion, the python, and the cage. And the panic comes from the fact that he has the premonition that the python is going to swallow the lion. It's premonitory. Will it happen? Will love be swallowed, digested, excreted by the python? I don't know. The same with the towers. So I don't want to give you comfort or to make you believe something. You know, it's up to each of us, of course, differently.
Sense that we were hoping this would be an informal gathering reception. Maybe we could